Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast, episode 12, Modernizing the Force, working in a staff job, good lord. I'll try to not make this very technical and gear focused. I just want to make it kind of lessons learned. Let me address something real quick before we jump into that episode. On the Jack Carr podcast, I said something about not growing up real confident or not being confident. And a couple of people sent me kind of follow-up questions on that, and I just want to clarify it. Growing up in Ireland, I grew up at a time when kids were seen, they're meant to be seen and not heard, right? And speaking in the room with adults, it just wasn't done. Now, I'm sure there's plenty of people that grew up in Ireland at the same time as me and are super confident. I think part of it's baked into your DNA, and it is who you are, but raising kids with confidence lacking confidence, it's a crutch, it really is. Now, a young man asked me, look, how do you change that without being overconfident? And if you're a leader especially, you can't change who you are. The older I get, the more I realize that everybody around you is faking it, man. I haven't met that many experts in anything. And even in this world here with podcasts and social media and all these guys with marketing degrees and all this crap, and you look at them and you're like, it's an inch deep. So you can't change who you are. But just realize that all these super confident people, a lot of them are just faking it. They're just, it's an inch deep. I have a couple of examples. I remember being in basic training in Ireland. And we were a couple of months in, and I was just doing my thing and getting along. And the first couple of weeks I struggled because I was not in the Army Reserves. So I didn't know all the Irish words of command, and I didn't know how to march, and a lot of guys were. And it was comical. But I kind of was drawn to it, and I picked it up pretty quickly, and I became fairly good at it, I guess. I remember a couple of months in, there was a guy in my squad, and he said, there was three awards at the end of training. One was best shot, one was best kit, you know, equipment and all that, keeping clean, and one was best soldier. And near the end, or a couple of months in, the guy said, I think you would be picked as best soldier. And I was like, what? No, not a chance. And he kind of laid it out. He's like, hey, you're physically fit. You know, you don't make mistakes. You do this. And he laid it out. And I was just like blown away by that. No, I didn't get it in the end. It was between me and another guy. And we went to the MAG 58 machine gun range, which is the 240 Bravo, basically, in the American Army. And a good friend of mine, Herr Dencio, was talking behind us saying, it was between me and another guy, saying whichever one gets the best score on the machine gun. And he came and told me, and my gun, there's a thing called a runaway gun with a machine gun because it fires from an open bolt. And it's when the mechanism works enough to eject the spent cartridge and load it around, but it doesn't push the bolt back far enough to engage the sear and lock it to the rear. Just basically when you squeeze the trigger and let it go, it just keeps firing. The only way to stop it is to twist the belt. So my gun was malfunctioning, and runaway gun, I had a terrible score, and the other guy got it. But when the guy asked me that question, that was one of the examples. Now, I had other examples like that throughout my career, where people were like, you could do this, and here's a fieldcraft one. Mike Glover said to me one day, just turn the camera on and start talking. And I said, Mike, I can't do that. That's you. That's not me. I'll never be able, and look at me now, right? But that self-doubt can be a crutch. Now, it's worse to be overconfident to me. I've worked with a lot of guys in my career. I've worked with humble, hardworking, solid, grounded people. I've also worked with cocky assholes who think they know everything. And I'd much rather have the grounded, humble guy. They're more professional. They're more careful in what they do because they don't want to screw up. And that's just me. So I don't think you can change it. I think you just need to get to a point in your life where you realize that all these people you think are experts, they're not. And the internet is full of them. It's full of these guys who pretend to be something they're not. And they're super confident. It's a very infectious thing, right? It's very, very, it draws you to people when they're super confident. And not being confident is not a good trait. But just know that sometimes behind that facade, there's not a whole lot going on. Okay? Hope that makes sense. All right, force modernization. When I finished up as a first sergeant, I had a choice, and I went to the force modernization office, which I didn't even know existed before this. a good friend of mine was like, hey, this job is opening up in target engagement. The force modernization represented Green Berets who represented the force in Special Forces Command to USSOC and SOCOM, right? USSOC being all Army Special Operations and SOCOM being all military special operations. And basically, when you build or you spec or you kind of pursue a new piece of equipment, you need both engineers in there writing specs and you need soldiers, because soldiers look at things differently and then engineers and vice versa. So it's a team effort, because engineers will field equipment and they just don't understand. When they put it in front of you, you go, I would never carry this. It's too freaking heavy. It's too bulky. It shines. Whatever way. So, and you need experienced soldiers to do that. It's not something junior guys can do. So the Force Modernization Office in Special Forces Command had about 14, 15 Green Berets in it. And it ended up being 8 different commodity areas dealing with millions and millions of dollars and hundreds of programs. So the way it works, we were Army, even though we're Special Forces, we're still in the Army, and we get all the Army equipment that pertains to our job. And we get the same equipment as infantry soldiers, right? So the Army has Beretta pistols, we get Beretta pistols. The Army has M4s, we get M4s, 240 machine guns, saws, the radios, the trucks, all that stuff, because we're part of the fighting force in the Army. Now, when that equipment does not meet our needs, then we had our own money, SOCOM money, that we could spend and pursue something different that meets our requirements. And a good example is the Army were fielding the PVS-14. It's a monocular. It only sees through one eye. And it's honestly a great piece of kit. I ran all over the freaking world with that thing attached to my face. But SOCOM have PVS-31 alphas, which are dual tubes. We kind of like to see out of both eyes at night. We're kind of quirky that way. Dual tube night vision goggles, white phosphorus, phenomenal night vision goggles, right? Now, for us to buy dual tube goggles for a small force, compared to the big Army, it's much cheaper, right? We have maybe a couple of thousand guys, and the Army has a massive amount of people. So we get all the Army gear. When that gear did not meet our requirement for our mission, then we would spend our own money and augment that gear. And sometimes we'd modify it, and sometimes we'd buy something new. And now we still got the regular Army gear. So on my team, when I was a team sergeant, I had all the Army stuff, I had all the Special Forces stuff, and I had all the CRIF stuff. So I had Beretta pistols. I also had Glock 19s. I also had 40 caliber Glocks with suppressors that came through. Like, I had ridiculous amounts of gear. So not under-equipped by a long shot. When I went in initially, I went in to take the target engagement job. Target engagement dealt with guns, bullets, optics, night vision, thermal weapon sights, anything to do in that kind of realm, visual augmentation, binocular spot and scopes, all kinds of stuff. There was, it changed while I was there, but there was 8 commodity areas within the Special Forces Command G8 Force Modernization section. There was, and I have some notes for this one, the first time ever, because it's a long kind of complicated thing, and I don't want to bore people to death with programmatics, and I promise I won't, but there was a lot of lessons learned. It was both a very frustrating job and a very, very rewarding job, but it did kind of make me work hard. I was laughing this morning because, you know, I took over sniper school and I changed some stuff and I changed what I thought was broken, and then I went to my team and I kind of modified things and I pushed where I needed to push, and then I went to, where did I go after that? First sergeant job at the Warrior Leader Course, and I changed and fixed that. And then I went to Force Mod and I changed and fixed that. And then, you know, if you've been divorced 5 times, maybe it's you. Maybe I'm the problem. Maybe I'm overthinking things, but I can't help who I am. So within the office, there was target engagement, guns, bullets, optics, all kinds of stuff. Mobility, trucks, freaking motorcycles, snowmobiles, jet ski, all kinds of anything vehicular. Soldier systems, uniforms, body armor, rucksacks, cold weather gear, anything in that realm. The CRIF had a representative up there for CRIF equipment. PSYOPs, robotics, communications, and intel systems. And I'll talk a little bit about those, but I don't want to get too technical. This is not about gear. And maybe I can do a follow-up on specific gear if people want to hear that. So when the Army buys equipment, It's not like you just go out and buy, oh, we like that rifle, or we like that truck, you want to buy it. It's not like that. It has to go into a fair and open competition. This is the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations. It has to go into a fair and open competition, and everybody gets to compete, and it has to be tested based on specifications, which are written by my office, basically, and approve the use of socket SOCOM. And everybody get, and there's a fair and open competition. That's why it takes 5 years to get a piece of kit. And a lot of times, especially in the Intel world, in the technology world, kit is outdated by the time you put it on the freaking battlefield. In SOCOM, requirements, capability gaps are bottom-up driven. Team says, this is what we could not do in our last mission. And it gets pushed up to SF Command, validated by the general, pushed to USASOC, pushed to SOCOM. So it's a bottom-up driven process. The Army's not like that. The Army is top-down driven. A bunch of people at the Pentagon get together and they say, we need a new gun, new bullet, new truck. And they kind of work that system through Picatinny or, you know, Aberdeen Proving Grounds. And soldiers are taught, brought in to test it periodically. But it's not really a soldier-driven thing, which is a very dangerous concept. And you will get, you will end up fielding equipment that nobody wants, and we can talk about that later on. So when I went in there, I was just going into the target engagement, bullets, optics, guns. Now, I'd taken a bonus through the Army. I think I talked about that. I'd taken a bonus for 6 more years, which was not a great idea, honestly. And they gave me a pretty good chunk of money. And so I was like, oh God, I'm going to be at a desk. So if I'm going to be at a desk, let me make a difference. Then you have to be, you have to realize if you stay in the Army long enough, you are going to a staff job, especially if you're done with Team Sergeant time and you're moving on. Even if you become a Sergeant Major, that's a staff job, really. Officers go behind a desk much faster. If you're an infantry officer, you get a year or two as a platoon leader, then you're the XO and you're the company commander and you're kind of sort of with the guys, but you can go to SF then and become a Special Forces officer. But once you're 2 years done on an ODA, you are behind a desk for the rest of your career. So people have asked me, what's better? It depends what you want. If you want more time, you know, NCOs get to play soldier much, much longer than officers. But it depends what you want. So I went there and I knew nothing about the acquisitions process, but I tried to learn it because you can't circumvent the rules unless you know what the rules are. So I went in and I dug into regulations, I dug into processes, I took a bunch of courses online. I went to an actual 1 week school and then I went later to a 2 week school, and I really wanted to learn how this stuff worked because I thought that I could make a difference and I could work process and get stuff done. Now there's no fast wins in this office. It takes years and it's very frustrating, and you got to deal with a lot of people, and you're also working in an environment with civilians, government civilians, and you got to tread lightly because they, well, I'll get to that later on. When I got in there first, the first program that kind of hit my desk was the PSR, the Precision Sniper Rifle, which was being worked, and it had been down selected and it had been won by Remington. Now, this is a poorly written program, and even I knew that early on. I was like, oh my God, because the people in my office in USASOC and SOCOM, they'd written the scope, the gun, and the suppressor all together as one program. So basically, if a company wanted to compete, they partnered with a scope company, and they partnered with a suppressor company if they didn't make their own, and submitted that as a package. It seems like a good idea up front, but it's a terrible idea because you might end up with a good gun, a great suppressor, and a crap scope, or great scope, terrible suppressor, terrible gun. You know, they're coming, you have to separate them, okay? I'm sorry, the ammo was included too. It was the gun, the ammo, and the scope all together. And again, gun company's gonna just partner with whatever ammo's on the shelf and throw it out there. So there wasn't any incentive to really innovate and come up with something new. And the specs were badly written. It wasn't well done. So I got in there at the tail end, and Remington still had the contract, and they were testing it, and it was failing. Even though it had been down selected, it was getting tested again because it was failing. And I went to one of the tests, and it just wasn't getting there. And I didn't have the rank or the power to kill that program, but I have the influence to go talk to the guy with the rank and the power and to get that motion going. And it was my opinion that it would be easier to kill this program and just start again. So that's what we did. We killed that program and we started the Advanced Sniper Rifle program. And that's when I was in target engagement. The first thing I did before we wrote the specs was I brought every single acquisitions officer, contracting officer, every person all the way up through USASOC and SOCOM, in the Navy, in the Marine Corps, everybody that would be involved and have a decision on this gun. I brought them all to Todd Hodnett's in Texas for a week. I brought Brian Litz in for 2 days to teach ballistics classes. And we, because they just didn't understand, well, you can't test a gun for accuracy at 1,500 meters, right? There's too many variables. Shooting a gun from a rest instead of a shoulder gives you a misrepresentation of what that gun can do. There was a whole bunch of things that were done wrong. So we went down there and we started writing the document and pushing that program forward. We picked the bullet first. And then when we found the bullet we wanted, we pushed that to industry and told them to build a gun around the bullet. The bullet and the gun are a team. You can't separate them. It was a very successful program. And we pulled in the Army early on. We pulled in the Marine Corps early on. We gave them a seat at the table. And we all wanted, when we all work together, the Navy, the Army, the Marine Corps, you can't stop us. It's when everybody has different requirements. The requirement for a sniper rifle for the Army infantry is no different than special operations. Shooting things at long range is shooting things at long range. There is certain soft, peculiar requirements, especially in the intel field, that are very, very soft, peculiar. That's not one of them. It's a sniper rifle. Come on, get over yourself, right? So we brought him in early and we worked together very, very closely, and it made the program a success. And when we fielded the first few guns, that the Barrett MRAD won the competition, right? It met every specification we put out there. And I will say that Barrett were a pleasure to work with from day one. And I can't say that about all the other companies. They were very professional. They, like, I've sat down with gun companies and they would argue specifications and I'd be like, check it out. And I'm very direct. And I feel like it's just a better way to be. Maybe I'm just grumpy in my old age, but this half-assing and kind of speaking around things, I'd be like, hey, check it out. These are the specs. You don't even know why I have this requirement. Either compete or don't compete. I don't care. But this is the specification, right? Barrett were never like that. They were like, what do you guys need? Boom, done. What else? What else? What else? Super professional company to work with. And they crushed it. That is a badass gun. And like I said earlier, sometimes it takes 5 years to get a program. And by the time you field it, it's outdated. That Barrett MRAD is the best long-range sniper rifle in the world, bar none. It's badass. And it's a fantastic gun. And I'm really, really happy that we got it across the finish line, because getting things across the finish line in this world is not easy. But we got the Army to pick it up as a program, which means the Army buy it and field it to SOCOM, which means we don't have to use SOCOM dollars on it. And it's not even the guns. The guns in the grand scheme of things are cheap. It's the three calibers of ammunition for the next 20 years. It's a lot of money. And it's a lot of SOCOM money I don't have to spend on that. I can spend on other things. And that's always the goal. And we should be working joint programs because we're all in the same fight. And we're not that special, right? So that was a great program. That moved across and got done and got fielded. And I was a big part of that starting up. The other things, a couple other things that were going on at the time. I took a couple of notes here just from memory. The URGI, the Upper Receiver Group, improved. That was a new upper for the M4. The SEALs were pushing the surged suppressed upper receiver group. We did not buy in on that in SOCOM because we get M4s from the Army. It's cheaper for us to just modify it with an upper than buy a whole new gun. INOD Block 3 was a thermal weapon sight that we fielded for snipers. That is just incredible. The Recon 5 from FLIR is in a thermal weapon sight. The biggest gap that USASOC, SOCOM, Special Forces have is training. Net training. Net training is new equipment training, right? And the way it works, it's built in, the price of new equipment training is built into the programmatics, right? And when you build a program like this, it's cradle to grave. It's all the way through the life cycle of the gun, repairs, even disposal of guns that are taken out of the system. But net is put in there, but it's a check the box. What happens is, in USASOC at the time, they have a net training team. They're required SF guys, but they basically get this new equipment, they read the manual, and then they go around the groups and train people. And SF is so freaking busy that, you know, net training will be put on. It's supposed to be 30 Green Berets in there, and there's two Green Berets, two cooks, and a transportation kid, and they're supposed to train everybody else, and they don't. And the training never gets filtered down, and you end up using your equipment to a fraction of its capability. And that's just a fact. And I've done it myself. I worked at SODIC for 3 years, at Sniper School for 3 years, and I learned that the rangefinder we had, you could actually, had a compass, you could actually press it in a direction and drag it, and you could measure an HLZ from a height set. You could do all kinds of stuff. But when I was on a team, I didn't actually use it as a rangefinder. I didn't know the capability of it. So we had a massive gap in using our equipment to its full potential. Mark 47 was a great example too. Mark 47 was a grenade launcher, an automatic grenade launcher, SOCOM issued. Now the Army used the Mark 19, but the Mark 47 had a thermal weapon sight and a fire control system in it. Most guys didn't know how to use it. Okay. Now, I started an initiative when I was in Force Mountain, when I took over the NCYC, to make basically YouTube for training videos for SOCOM. Now, obviously, it can't be open source. It has to be behind, on a portal, behind a closed system that you can only get into with your Army ID card. And we had it, and we built it, and I built into the requirements. I don't know if it's still there or not, but SOCOM, USASOC bought off, and SOCOM bought off, to put it in the requirements that each, the winner of each program, that industry needs to build a video, a training video, for their piece of equipment that can be put on this closed portal. So soldiers, like say I was at SWIC, I was an instructor of 3 years, and I get back to my team and have a new piece of kit, and there was no net training, and I can go to somewhere and I can watch a freaking video on how to use that piece of equipment to its full potential. It's YouTube, right? You wanna do anything now? You want to fix your car, you go to YouTube and you watch a video and you go in there and you figure the damn thing out. And that's how people learn these days. And we got it up and we got it running, and I got a bunch of videos on there, but it was a nightmare getting people. Like, I remember briefing all the group commanders, all the group CSM, all the group warrants about this. And they were all pretty much pissed that they had to make a username and password to get in there, right? And I'm like, oh my God. And I remember one of them said, I just need an app on my phone. And I'm like, great, you're still going to have to register and make a username and password. It's not just going to magically appear on your phone. Sometimes these senior leaders are out of touch, honestly. And when I left, it was up and running, but I don't know if it got killed. That's the problem, right? You leave and things get shut down. So somebody hit me up the other day about it. And I said, look, you have to go on the portal, man. Go to SF Command, go to G8. Go to Force Mod, and if it's still there, then it's in there, and the videos are there. But it takes somebody to keep pushing that, or it just dies. It dies a death. But training is the biggest gap we have. I used to brief the senior leader course every class. The senior leader course is 128 Green Berets, E7s, Sergeant First Class, who are becoming Master Sergeants, right? Guys at the tip of the spear. I used to brief them about Force Mod every class. I would go up there, and I'd talk about all the programmatics and this and that and the other, and I would say, give me a show of hands. What do you not have that you need? And I'd normally not get any hands, or one or two. And then I'd say, what do you have on your team that you'd like to turn in because you have too much stuff? And every hand would go up. And I already knew the answer to what they wanted to get rid of. And there's programmatic reasons why they can't. And you have so much gear on a team that it's out of control. But you can make a difference in that job. It just takes a long, long time. So the other commodities, when I was there a year, the colonel in charge of the G8 is it's a shop in SF Command headquarters, and it is funding, it is force structure, like all the people and all that, you know, this number ODAs and this number in each company and where all the people go, and, you know, attachments with NBC and supply and all that, for, and it takes a very unique person to book that stuff, and that had nothing to do with me, thank God. So there's funding, there's force structure, and there's force mod, and I was the force mod guy. I was the non-commissioned officer that moved me up. The colonel brought me in his office and he said, hey, the guy who's the NCOIC is leaving and we're going to make you the NCOIC. And I said, I don't want that job. And he said, well, you're in the Army, so you'll do what you're told. And I was like, damn it, he's right. So I reluctantly took over as the non-commissioned officer in charge. Now, up to this point, I was dealing with guns and bullets and optics and all the cool stuff that I really like to deal with. And now I'm in a shop that has, and they restructured a little bit, and they hired two GS-13s. One was the former regiment command sergeant major, who knows SF inside and out. And the other was a female. I'm not going to say her name because she still works up there. She was a younger female who was a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve in PSYOPs. And she was an absolute rock star, man. She was brilliant and highly intelligent, very experienced. I'd bounced around a couple of very unique jobs. I want to podcast her because her story is amazing, but she still works up there. But so the guy who was the former regiment CSM, he dealt with four commodity areas. He dealt with target engagement, mobility, all the trucks, all the Humvees, the GMV-1, that one, motorcycles, jet skis, snowmobiles, non-standard vehicles, so these armored vehicles that were, they looked like vehicles downrange that you could use for low-vis stuff, all those programs. He dealt with the CRIF stuff, and he dealt with soldier systems. Soldier systems, uniforms, we had Patagonia uniforms, we had different backpacks, different body armor, low-vis body armor, vests, NBC gear, cold weather gear, wet weather gear, all that stuff that goes on your body. He dealt with all that stuff. It's funny because when you test equipment, like when we were picking a new backpack, we took the labels off all the backpacks because guys get, oh, I want this, I want freaking Tier Tactical, or I want this. And no, judge it on your on its capability and not on your preconceived notion of what it does. So when that guy managed those four commodity areas, which hundreds and hundreds of programs. And this other female, she managed communications, which is a massive commodity, and millions and millions and millions of dollars. Intel systems, tracking and tagging, a lot of other stuff that I'm not going to talk about. PsyOps, and then robotics, drones and counter drones, air UASs, mapping drones, all this thing, and drones and counter drone is a massive it's a massive undertaking, not just by the military, but a lot of organizations and throughout the world, because small UAVs, it's not even them flying stuff over, dropping it on you, which is a problem. It's them knowing where you are and doing reconnaissance all the time. And it's a twofold problem. It's detection, which is difficult, and then it's interdiction and shutting it down and taking out the operator, and there's a whole lot to it. And there's so many systems and so much testing, and you can't just test that stuff anywhere. If you're shutting off signals, there's only a few places in the States where you can do it, because you don't want to be interfering with commercial aircraft. So it's a massive undertaking. So she managed that, COMO, Intel systems, PsyOps, and robotics. Massive amount of work, and very intelligent, very capable woman. So I had a rock star team. And then within each one of those commodities, I had two Green Berets at each one, senior guys, mostly ex-team sergeants, and then PsyOps, I had two PsyOps people. You know, people say it's hard to be a leader in SF because when you're on a team, you have a team full of E7s and they're all A-types. In Force Mod, I had a team full of team sergeants. But I handpicked them. If people didn't work out, I fired them. Now, I didn't fire them and hurt their career. I just moved them somewhere else. I had a very good relationship with the command sergeant major, the regiment command sergeant major. And I'd go up and I'd say, look, this guy's not a bad guy. He's just not suited for this job. And we'd move him somewhere else, and I'd handpick a guy and I'd pull him in there. I handpicked a bunch of guys that were on a team with me that I worked as sniper instructors for me, and I knew they were subject matter experts. But even more than that, they had the personality to get stuff done, to interact with people and talk to industry, and they weren't trying to line their own pockets and get free shit, because that drives me crazy. Their loyalty was to the regiment and not to some company that gave them a free gun or whatever that was. And I would crush them if they did that. I would destroy them. And that's what made me the right guy actually for that job, because I can't be swayed. I want the best capability, and I don't care who wins. And a lot of these companies I knew from before, from being a sniper instructor, but I don't care. You bring it, and if it wins, it wins, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. So with those commodities came hundreds and hundreds of programs and millions of dollars. And it was, now I wasn't, my guys in each commodity were very, very tied up in everything. I was an inch deep and a mile wide, and I understood all the programs, understood the pros and cons and capabilities, and I made decisions directing those programs, but based on my guys' input. And everybody who came in my office to explain stuff, their thing was the most important thing in the world, and they all needed millions of dollars. And you know, you get the JTAC come in talking about dropping bombs and training and all this, and then the world will end if he doesn't get this. And then you get the next guy come in, he's a dog handler, and the world will end if he, you know. And it was a balance, because you don't have an unlimited budget, and you're dealing with taxpayer money, and you're trying to be a good steward of taxpayer money. But nobody wants to say no, and nobody wants to be the adult in the room. And I was the adult in the room a lot, and I said no a lot, and people lose their freaking minds. So this is how it's supposed to happen in SF Command. It didn't always happen like this. A team says, hey, this is what we couldn't do. They go to their S8 shop, which the S8 is like a little force mod office within each group. Now, some of those S8s were great guys, really knowledgeable and really capable, and some of them were just duds who were getting ready to retire, and they didn't know where to put them, so they stuck them in there. And they'd come to me at Chacho, and they go, oh, we found these new nods, they're really cool. I'd be like, great, not buying nods. And he did say, well, my group commander said, I was like, I don't care what your group commander says, not buying nods. We have nods. We have 31 alphas. They're phenomenal. Unless there's a leap in technology, not even looking at nods for a couple of years. Well, these ones are, I don't care. We don't have the money. And we the nods we have meet our requirement. And they'd be mad at that. I'd be like, what do you want me to do? Lie to you and just tell you we're doing stuff? We're not. So I got to the point where I was super blunt with people, to include group commanders and the CG. And it was getting to the point where I was like borderline disrespectful, because I was just tired of the facade. Every single new general that come in to SF command, we had spear equipment, right? Uniforms, body armor, different than regular army. Body armor that was more maneuverable for people who closed with and fought the enemy. And it went to people on the front lines, mostly Green Berets, but it went to other people who were actually on the front lines. And the GS-13 who ran that commodity, who was the regiment CSM and understood SF command in a way that I never would, he wrote up a whole fielding requirement based on the funding we had on who gets this gear. Of course, everybody wanted it. It's this the culture of everybody gets a trophy. So you get all these people coming in going, we need this, we need this. And I'll be like, no, you don't have the money. And every time a new CG come in, he'd sit down and he'd say, I want every single person in SF command, which is 23,000 people, to get this gear. And, you know, the civilians who worked there would know that he'd be gone in a year. So they'd just play along. They'd go, okay, we'll do our analysis. And I'd be like, no, we won't. We already did it. It's millions of dollars you don't have. Not going to happen. But nobody wanted the truth. And it's brutal. And it's the same on the outside. Nobody wants the truth when you work for a civilian company either. So they'd write a 9-line requirement. It'd get signed by the group commander and it would get pushed up to SF command. We would look at it. We would write up a requirements document that would, if we thought it was something that we actually did need, because we got some ridiculous stuff, we'd push it up to the commander, the general, he'd sign it and go to USASOC. And it gave USASOC kind of the authorization to start working on this stuff. And it'd go to SOCOM. And it was a long, long, drawn-out process, but that's how it was supposed to work. The 1-6, the LPVO, they call it now, the 1-6 variable optic that we have in SF command, SIG Tango won it. I started that program. When I got the Force Mod first, I went to a Force Mod kind of conference with all the groups. It was out in Utah. And I said, guys, let's get rid of the LCAN. Let's find a 1-6 optic. Because I just come back from Iraq, multiple trips, clearing houses, going to the roof, and putting down my M4 and pulling out a sniper rifle. I said, we need something that I can clear a house with, go to the roof, go to 6 power, and go to work. And I said, who's going to write the 9-liner? And third group said, we will. So we got back and I waited and I emailed them and I called them and I went down there and, oh yeah, we're working on. I just got fed up waiting. So I wrote it myself and I started the whole program myself. And that's not supposed to be how it works, but I got fed up waiting. And it took a couple of years. But what we did too was, you have to be very careful when you write specifications for a program. Because if you say, I want a bullet that goes 3,500 feet per second, right? And because that's what I want. And you put that out as a specification to industry, and physics and science and technology is just not there. They'll all work on it. They'll all submit. But because it was an unrealistic requirement, you'll be a year in and $1 million in testing and all the guns will fail. And this is just an example. It's made up numbers, right? So you have to ask for something that's it's testable, it's feasible, and you can get there, right? It's so you have to ask for something that's enough of a leap above what you have to make it worthwhile financially, but not so high that it's just going to fail because technology is not there. And there was a lot of that would go on to be like, push industry, make them do this. And I'd be like, okay, that's not going to happen. It doesn't matter how much you want it. Physics will get in the way. So, you know, we did the LPVO to make sure we wrote a good document. I had moved on, by the time it came in and got started, I'd moved on to the NCIC and I handpicked a guy that was on my team and who was my sniper partner who just got done running sniper school to run this program because it was too important and to run the advanced sniper rifle program. And he pulled in Rangers and SEALs and operators and SF guys, and they all went to Range 37 here in Bragg for a week. And we bought every single optic on the market. And they shot them. They did CQB with them. They shot them short range, long range, tried different reticles, tried different systems, everything. Shot at night, shot movers. And on the last day, they all sat down and representation from every group, from everybody who was getting this product, and said, okay, guys, what do we want? What's the power range? First focal plane, second focal plane, what kind of reticle? That's how programs are supposed to be built, because nobody knows everything. And when you write specifications in a vacuum, you're going to mess it up. You're going to miss something, right? So that now was won, that program was won by SIG, and the SIG Tango is the optic that came out of that program. There's a bunch more examples. Yeah, I just wrote down a new requirement has to be achievable, testable, and reasonable, right? Because if it's not testable, then it has to go to a full and open competition. So, and that's the law. That's the federal acquisitions regulations. So my daily routine when I worked in there, I'd go in at 7. I'd be in my seat in my chair at 7 o'clock in the morning before anybody got there, because I got 2 hours of work done before the craziness started. And the first thing I'd do, I had a red computer, which was a secret computer, and I had a regular green computer. I get on my red computer and I get an Intel update from Fortcom every morning. And I go through that, just looking at different equipment, different armies, and what kind of the trend was out there. And then I'd start and I'd get into emails and everybody CC'd me on everything, and I had to dig through all this stuff, and it was exhausting, but I had to do it. I also had guys traveling all over the place. We sent our soldier system guy to Finland to test cold weather gear. I sent my target engagement guys to a bunch of scope companies to watch how scopes are built start to finish, because you can't write specs if you don't understand what goes into it, right? But it became a horrible work environment, because they put us in this office space with the people who worked in force structure and in financing. And a lot of them, there's some great GS civilians in the military, there really is. But the ones up there did nothing, and they're unfireable because the system is built that way. And they figured out a way to make money when they leave. And I really shouldn't talk about this because I'm going to piss people off, but I don't care. There was a job opened up, a GS-13 job, and there was a little old lady there who'd been there for 50 years. And she was retiring anyway, but she put in for that job and she didn't get it. They gave it to a retired lieutenant colonel who was awesome. And she sued for ageism and sexism. And they paid her off, because it became the policy just to pay people off, because it's cheaper in the long run. You don't drag it out for years and you don't admit guilt. So people understood that if you build up this pattern of hostile work environment, then you sue and you'll get paid off. And it became so common that people, civilians in USSR, called it the parting gift. Now, we became the target of that, because I got 14 Green Berets who F and talk on the phone out loud, and they're next to these cubicles. And every time my guide said anything they didn't like, they wrote it up and they reported it. And I became the PC police, me of all people, telling people to be quiet, don't say this, don't say that. It became a horrible work environment. At one point, we had mannequins that with all our kit on them, and third group were doing a demo. Instead of having soldiers stand there with all that kit on, they borrowed our mannequins. And when they dropped them back, they were naked. They had no genitalia, but they were naked. And that was reported as a sexual harassment thing, because the mannequins had no clothes. It got so ridiculous that they actually launched a 15-6 investigation against us all. They accused people of time fraud, and it was all BS. And but they automatically believed that. It got so bad, I moved all the force mod people out of that building. I found another building, and we moved away, because it got to be so bad. I was telling people to work from home, because I wouldn't give them the ammunition against us. Vile, horrible, horrible people. And I'm sure it's like that in civilian world in some companies too. And that's why I freaking can't do it. But I used to go to SHOT Show. I used to go to AUSA, SOFIC. SHOT Show to me was just work. It was meetings for like 3 or 4 days. The first time I went there, I remember I had a Garmin watch, and I walked 14 miles one day around SHOT Show. And it's just a place to get to link up in industry when everybody's there. Didn't do any partying, didn't do any of that. It was just work. But I would get people coming up to me all the time when they figured out who I was, and trying to sell me stuff. And I'd be blunt. I'd be super blunt, because I think you owe it to people to tell them the truth. I'd be like, look, never going to pursue that. Never going to happen. Well, I talked to a guy in first group. It doesn't matter. He has no say. You talk to a guy in a team, he has no say in requirements. I'm sorry to say that, but he doesn't. They're all joint and they're all pushed from SOCOM, and it has to be a real requirement to put any money behind it. Now, I'm not talking about buying a couple. I'm talking about an actual requirement. I got to know some great people in industry too, some great representatives of equipment. But a lot of them, they'd call me up and I'd be like, look, stop giving, like they'd give one of the groups triggers and they'd come to me, but you don't want this trigger. I'm like, I'm not buying that trigger. I'm not going to happen. Well, my group commander said, I don't care. Look, here's what goes into putting a new trigger in your gun, in your rifle. You have a Geissele trigger, fantastic trigger. If I wanted to put that trigger in, I would have to test like 10 of them. I'd have to run thousands of rounds through each one because I can't test one to make sure it wouldn't fail. I have to buy that ammo. I have to pay contractors to do that. It'll take a year and it'll cost $1 million for something you think is incrementally better. I'm not going to do it. Waste the taxpayers' money. People didn't want the truth. People didn't want to be told the truth, especially commanders. But I couldn't sugarcoat things. It became a tough place to work, man. And near the end, it got really bad. And I was like, this is ridiculous. A new CG came in and he said, my number one priority is innovation, right? Nobody knew what that meant. Most people thought it meant going to SHOT Show and finding a new product and trying to buy it. That's not innovation. They brought this system to me one time. Oh, I won't mention what it is, but it's extremely expensive. Oh, we found this new system. I said, it's not new. Saw a demo for this 10 years ago. That's not innovation. Innovation is, the best way I heard it described, is a simple solution to a complex problem. And like I said, most of the gaps were in training. But when you say no, because you're trying to do the right thing, you become the roadblock. And luckily, I really don't care what they thought of me. I did what was right. So when I was near the end of that process, when I was 2 years out from retirement, I couldn't wait to get out of the Army. I was done. And I started documenting my medical problems, right? Because I hadn't been to a doctor in 15 freaking years. Because on a team, you just go to your medic. And he gives you Motrin, you suck it up, move on. And I knew I had a lot of physical problems. And I'd been told that, look, 2 years out, you can start documenting all your stuff because it takes a while. So I went to a friend of mine who was a colonel, and he was a Green Beret, but he's a doctor in Swick, and he set me up with all the appointments, and he started sending me to get blood tests and x-rays and MRIs and all that. And it very, very quickly became evident that I wasn't really fit for duty because the requirements to be a Green Beret are pretty rugged, pretty stringent. And I was in great shape up until I sat behind a desk and I started falling apart, I think. Or maybe I was just in denial, but I started getting x-rays and MRIs and stuff. And they very quickly said, you meet the criteria to medically retire from the Army if you want. And I was like, really? And I had 2 years left at this point. So I did an MRI on my, or a scan or whatever, on my brain, and I had TBI pretty bad. TBI is traumatic brain injury. You get it from IEDs, from explosions, from breaching charges, from shooting a freaking recoilless rifle 50 times that you're only supposed to shoot 3 a day. It's just from that constant concussion that football players and boxers and that get. And it's not, I always thought it was like a subjective thing, you know. Come in and we'll give you these cognitive tests. It's actually just, it's a brain scan. There's white marks on your brain, apparently. And they're like, you have pretty severe TBI. Now, I don't think it affects me that much. My short-term memory is not great. My long-term memory is better, as you could probably attest. But sometimes I'll forget things if I don't write it down. That's why I write everything down. I have for years. So I had a TBI. Both my rotator cuffs are torn pretty badly. I have a fracture in my back. I had a lot of small injuries, and they just build up and build up and build up. So that doctor that was helping me out, he said, you have to go to this Army doctor in Fort Bragg, who authorizes all people who are looking for medical retirement. Now, he gets a lot of people in there faking it, and you get people who are in the Army for a couple of years, and they're looking for a check, and they're looking for a thing. Now, I had no intentions of medically retiring, but this doctor was helping me out in getting all my stuff straight. So if he told me to go, I'm going to go. So I went and saw this guy, and I'm in PTs. And I was told before I went, this guy's an ass. He's rude. He's ignorant. And now he deals with people trying to get over all the time. I get it. But I wasn't exactly a spring chicken. Like, yeah, I've been around a day or two at this point. So I go in and he's going through my medical stuff and all the stuff they're documenting now. And he goes, this is very interesting. Just smart ass. You had none of these injuries for 15 years and now all of a sudden they all hurt. And I was at a point in my life where I just couldn't take shit from people. And he's like a colonel or something. And I was like, let me stop you right there. Who the hell do you think you're talking to? The reason I didn't go to sick call is because I was fighting two freaking war. And I just went off on him. Like, I stood up and was standing over him, and he looked like he was pretty sure I was going to smack him, and I was pretty close. It takes a lot for me to lose my temper. I got a bad temper. I think it's an Irish thing, but I was like, who the hell do you think you're talking? I just went off on him, and he backed down right away. He knew he screwed up, and he started backpedaling, and I left, and I came back again. I had to go see him again, and I went back in uniform. Special Forces tab, freaking Jumpmaster, CIB, all the bling, right? So, and Master Sergeant, and I went in, and he was super nice to me, and he was apologetic, and it burns my ass. One of the things I hate most that really annoys me is civilians who work for the Army who treat soldiers like garbage. I hate it. And you see it a lot for the junior enlisted. I had a soldier that was trying to get stuff done one time, and he couldn't get help. And I was a first sergeant, and I walked in there with my freaking rank on and everything, and they were like, oh yes, first sergeant, we can do that. And completely different. I mean, if you can do it for him, if you can do it for me, why can't you do it for him? It's just, I hate that, right? So this guy was super apologetic, and he was like, look, I don't think you should get out. I think we broke you, and we will fix you. You need surgeries, you need this, you need that, you need the other. But I just wanted out at that point. I just wanted out. I couldn't. I had enough of it, and I just wanted to move on. So they have a thing called Intrepid Spirit, I think it is. They have it in DC, but they have it at Bragg, where they take people in, and they kind of make the process very, very easy for you. And it was great, man. I tell you, a lot of people complain about retiring, and the Army does nothing, and the VA does nothing. Me, that wasn't my experience. The Army, once I started that medical retirement stuff, they bent over backwards for me, and they really, really helped me. And they took all my x-rays, they took all my scans, they gave me any meds I needed. I had to go see a shrink up in Raleigh, a civilian shrink, combat related. And I sat down and talked to her for an hour, 2 hours, and she asked me about stuff, and I was very open with her. And I said, look, you get the usual question. Have you killed people? Yes. Have you seen people die? Yes. Have you seen friends die? Yeah, all those usual things. But I was very open and honest. I said, look, I have absolutely no regret about anything I did in combat. If you put me on that roof, if you put me behind that gun right now, I would do the exact same thing. And I think she was a little shocked by that, but no PTSD, none. Which is the right call. I didn't want that on my record anyway, but no PTSD. And PTSD and TBI have very similar symptoms, apparently, but none. I thought that the process of retiring was quite smooth. Now, they made me go to this, once I got authorized, I had to go to this transition thing. And there was a bunch of classes, and some of them were mandatory, but because of my rank, I didn't have to go to some. Like, I don't need to go to a class that teaches me how to balance a check, even though I don't know how to do that, because I never write checks, but I don't want to know. So there was some of them were just, but I went, and I checked the box, and I got out, and I haven't been to the, I don't think I've been to the doctor since I got out, and I've been out a couple of years, but I haven't been to the VA. And because I retired, I have TRICARE, which is the healthcare system, and I have the VA, so I really should go, but I don't like going. But my retirement process was not bad at all. And I think people complain a lot, but maybe they expect too much. The VA is the second biggest government organization in the United States. The only thing bigger is the US military. The VA is massive. They pour money into it. They pour it in. And yes, there's horrible things happen, and people have horror stories. I'm just saying that was not my experience. And all these things, when people leave and they have this sense of loss and loss of sense of purpose and all that kind of thing, I think I felt that when I got out of the Irish Army. And I think because I left a staff job where I sat behind a desk and argued with people all day long, I didn't have any of that. I was so happy to get out. And I was so relieved when I got to go pick up my DD-214, my paperwork, and walk out of Fort Bragg. I felt a massive weight lift off my shoulders. Now, I have no regrets. I had a great career. None of it was planned. It just kind of fell in that way. And I met some amazing people. But when I get out, I was very, very, very happy to get out. And people ask me today, do you miss it at all? I'm like, absolutely not. I think guys who get out when they're 10 years in, or when they leave a team and get out, then they think about that team time. I think leaving from a staff job is different, right? Because you're just like, this sucks, man. This is not what I wanted to do. But at a certain point, that is your career. And Some guys are team guys all the way to the end and they get out, but that was not my path. I was an E8 for half of my career probably, and I was in charge for half of my career, in charge of stuff. And it's very hard for me now not to be in charge of stuff and in charge of my own destiny. Working with people who I didn't respect, that were just looking for money, and accusing people of sexual harassment and hostile work environment and all that. That took a little piece of me, man. That broke me down, and that drove me out the door. And I wouldn't have taken that medical retirement if it wasn't for that. It was horrible. So, man, that was kind of downer. I want to end on a high note. So, 55, man, I'm getting good at keeping these at an hour. I know people want them longer, but I was going to say I can only talk for so long, but I talked to Jack Garr for 4 hours straight. So, as I was in the process of medically retiring, there was people that me and Mike Glover knew mutually that were telling me, oh, Mike's all over the internet, Mike's this, Mike's that. And I had no Instagram, I had no YouTube, I had nothing. I barely had an email address. And so I looked Mike up and I read some of the comments that he'd had and some of the things he was talking about. It was all very positive and it was all very mentorish type. And I actually liked it. I found it very refreshing. So I shot him an email and he called me and we talked for like 2 hours. And he's like, I want you to come teach Long Gun for me. And I'm like, okay. So I went out to Arizona, Prescott, Arizona. I taught a Long Gun course or two. And as I was transitioning out of the Army, and then on the day I picked up my DD-214 and transitioned out, I moved to Arizona. I drove out to Arizona, stopped in Colorado on the way out, and Matt Vandy, Matt Shea, and Mike, and we taught some infantry kids some shooting stuff. And I like to teach, man. That's my passion. And then I went out to Prescott. Now, my wife and kids were still in North Carolina, and I was doing this as an interim thing. And I did it for a while, and then I figured out I can't keep doing this. It's repeating a pattern I had in the Army where I put work first, right? You know, I was talking to Andy Stump about this, and Andy came up with a great phrase, work suffers last, the job suffers last. And that's a pattern I've done my whole career, and I wasn't going to do it again. So that's why I moved back. While I was out there, Mike had a service dog called Pearl that he'd gotten through an organization called Labs for Liberty in Utah, and I never thought I'd get a service dog, and I hadn't owned a Malinois before. I owned a bunch of dogs, and I love dogs, but I hadn't owned a Malinois. I'd worked with them in the military, obviously. And Mike said he would try to get me a Mal. And Labs for Liberty, I put my name down, and they didn't do Labs, or they didn't do, they didn't mostly do the Labs. They didn't do Malinois much, but there was a guy who had a Malinois, and it was trained, and he said it was aggressive, and it bit his kid. And they'd taken it back and given it to this sort of trainer. And I talked to the trainer and he said, I've tried to get this dog to bite me and he won't. And I don't buy it. He's the most trainable, smartest dog I've ever seen, is the trainer. So I was like, man, I'll take him. So I drove up there and I went to Utah. It was before we moved to Utah. And I met my dog, Vinny. And his name was actually Jimmy. And I changed it to Vinny because Vinny was the dog that me and Mike lost in combat. And I think it's a better name anyway. He didn't even notice. Dogs go in sounds, right? Vinny and Jimmy, he didn't even notice. So I spent a couple of days at that facility learning how to manage Vinny. And I will tell you now that I've had Vinny for a couple of years, there's absolutely no way he was aggressive. I think this kid was probably trying to make him a bite dog and he wouldn't bite. Vinny does not have an aggressive bone in his body. He's a sweetheart. He's highly intelligent. And he really, really, when I was out in Arizona and Utah for a little while, he was a great companion for me. And being a service dog, I can take him anywhere. And he is an absolute sweetheart and highly intelligent, so well trained, but he does not have an aggressive bone in his body. So this guy was BS, and I'm so glad I got him. He really, really, really did help me transition. All right, so I'm going to wrap it up there. I all these things, I'm just wave tops over them, but I don't want to go into too many technical things on this one, especially. If you have questions, I can go into more, if I'm allowed. I send a lot of non-disclosure agreements, so there's a lot of things I can't talk about, but if you have questions, I would answer them, if I can. On the next one, I'm going to talk about working for Fieldcraft and moving to Fieldcraft and moving to the first civilian job I ever had in my life, pretty much. Just real quick, shout out to Fieldcraft Training. Take a look, see if there's anything in your area. We have phenomenal instructors. Matt Shea, Matt Vandy, Casey Hildred, Kirsten Morgan. We have some great folks, and we have a lot. It's not just firearms. It's canning and jarring. It's medical training. It's survival. Kevin Estella is here now. He does survival. We got a lot of stuff going on. Just check it out. There might be something you want to jump in on. Okay, guys, until the next time, I appreciate you listening, and be safe.